This is Kirk Benroot for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Everyone loves a Halloween story, and our volunteers have got a few to tell you. So, welcome to the TRRS Midnight Macabre. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Listen to TRRS for announcements about program times, or check our website at www.triangleReadingService.org to review our complete schedule, or call us at 919-832-5138 with any comments or questions. That number again is 919-832-5138.
So who's with me tonight?
Hi, I'm Tara Smith.
Fred Corlett here.
Hello, I'm Diane Corlett.
Hi, I'm Gina Benoit.
Lindsay Moore here.
I'm Jeff Nugent.
I'm Gus Allen.
The Melt Shop, a Pennsylvania ghost story, retold by S. E. Schlosser. All the men working in the melt shop of the steel mill soon learned to be very careful around the furnace and the ladles full of molten steel. Every worker feared what would happen if the chains holding the ladles full of hot liquid ever broke while they passed overhead. Burning to death in molten steel might be a quick demise, but it would be agonizing. One poor fellow who used to work in the melt shop had tripped over a rigger hose back in 1922 and had fallen into a ladle full of hot steel. His body was immediately liquefied. There was nothing left for his family to bury, save for a small nugget of steel that was skimmed from the tainted ladle before its contents were dumped into a vacant lot. From that day onward, the workers said that the workman's ghost clanked and moaned its way around the shop at night, searching for his dead body. Now the newest steel worker, a young man recently moved to Pittsburgh, laughed mockingly when he heard the story about the ghost. He even volunteered to work the late shift, just to prove to the other men that they were wrong about the ghost. The young man liked the extra money this earned him, and soon his reputation for fearlessness and his scorn for the ghost were talk of the mill. There came an evening the young man found himself alone on the furnace floor. It was the slow time between shifts, and by rights he should already be on his way home. However, he had stayed behind for a moment to complete a small task, and he hummed contently to himself as he bent over his work. He gradually became aware of a muffled sound coming from somewhere to his left. He ignored it, since the mechanized processes all around him often made strange sounds. The sound grew louder, and the young man looked up from his labors to see a glowing white mist gathering in the air a few yards from where he stood. The mist emitted a faint rapping noise, which slowly clarified into the steady thud of a workman's approaching footsteps. The young man gasped, his arms breaking out into goosebumps in spite of the heat from the furnace. He watched with unblinking eyes and pounding heart as the mist solidified into a glowing figure of a workman making his rounds. Suddenly the workman tripped and fell downwards in slow motion towards a shimmering ladle full of steaming molten steel. The phantom workman's body plunged into the hot liquid, and he tried in vain to grab the sides of the ladle and pull himself out, unwilling to believe that he was doomed. Then his body liquefying beneath him, and his face hideously twisted with pain, the ghostly workman screamed desperately for someone to save him as he sank downward into the red-hot ladle. With a final hair-raising shriek, the apparition disappeared. The young man's scream of sheer terror was so loud that it cut through the voice of the phantom, echoing and re-echoing through the furnace room. Dropping his tools as if he were burning up, the young man raced for the exit, followed by the gut-wrenching sound of maniacal laughter. The young man packed his bag as soon as he got back to his lodging and returned home, never to enter a melt shop again. But the ghost of the dead steel worker continued to haunt the melt shop until it closed. They say that to this day, people walking near the spot where the melt shop once stood can still hear the steel worker's dying scream, followed by the sound of maniacal laughter.
Turnabout is Fair Play, a New Jersey ghost story retold by S.E. Schlosser. Everyone laughed at jumpy Uncle Phil, who believed the world was largely populated with monsters and ghosts and spooks and witches and werewolves. But he was considered harmless and no one much bothered about the poor fellow, until one summer when a new family moved to town with two naughty sons. As soon as they learned about jumpy Uncle Phil, those boys became obsessed with tormenting him. They snuck out to his place one night and painted hex signs over his barn. When Uncle Phil woke up the next morning, he ran all the way to the church, sure the devil was out to steal his soul away. The old man wouldn't leave until the minister went out and blessed his house. A week later, the boys gathered all of the black cats in town and put them into Uncle Phil's house. When Uncle Phil opened the door, fur flew everywhere as the black cats hissed and bit. Uncle Phil ran back to the church, and minister had to bless the house all over again. Then one night, they snuck into Uncle Phil's house through the parlor window, dragging a scarecrow with them. They set up the scarecrow so that it loomed over the poor sleeping man. Then they snuck out and positioned a lantern on a tree branch so that the light illuminated the scarecrow's face. The boys started moaning and groaning and calling Uncle Phil's name from the yard outside his bedroom window. Uncle Phil woke with a gasp and then screamed in sheer terror. Leaping off the bed, he dove out of his bedroom window and climbed into the tree. Below him, the lantern fell to the ground, setting fire to the wood pile beside the house. The boys stopped laughing and ran to the barn for something to put out the fire. Together, the boys managed to put it out, but the side of the house was scorched. The boys snuck into the house and removed the scarecrow before hightailing it home. In the morning, Uncle Phil came down from the top of the tree and went to fetch the preacher. Uncle Phil was sure devil had come and tried to take away his soul. The minister had to perform a third ritual cleansing of the farm before Uncle Phil would return to his property. The boys figured they'd better lay low for a while after the fire, so life went back to normal for Uncle Phil. Then, about a month after the devil's visit, Uncle Phil passed away in his sleep, and the boys were sure it was their fault. They felt terrible about it, but what could they do? Uncle Phil was gone. 2 weeks after Uncle Phil's death, the boys woke to find their bedrooms full of black cats. The boys were alarmed and could not convince their parents that they did not know how the cats got there. Then the boys came home from school one afternoon to find hex signs painted on their barn. The boys yelled in terror and ran inside their house, completely spooked. Later that night, the boys woke to hear a voice moaning their names. They sat up in their beds and saw the illuminated figure of a scarecrow looming in the center of the rooms. The boys screamed in terror. "I have come for your soul," it moaned, waving its arms about. The boy screamed again. Then the scarecrow started laughing. One boy reached up and snatched off the scarecrow's head, revealing the glowing, partially transparent face of Uncle Phil. "Gotcha," said the ghost of Uncle Phil with a huge grin. "After all, turnabout is fair play." Laughing and crying, the boys had to agree, and they never played practical jokes on anyone again.
The White Dove, a South Carolina ghost story, retold by S.E. Schlosser. A traveling salesman came to Goshen Hill for a few days, selling his wares from door to door. He was a friendly man with a warm grin and a joke for everyone. He was accompanied by a large white dog that rode on the wagon beside him, companion, friend, and guardian of his wares. The salesman and dog were making their way out of town when a murder was discovered in one of the places in which they had sported their wares. Suspicion blossomed at once against the stranger. Certainly no one the townsfolk knew was capable of committing such a crime, and a lynch mob chased the salesman out of town and strung him up on a tree beside the road. The white dog howled and barked and roared as the mob carried his master away. More than one man was bitten as the salesman, still screaming out his innocence, was silenced forever. One fellow finally shot his gun at the white dog, wounding it enough to send it whimpering away.
it soon became obvious to everyone in town that they'd hanged the wrong man. The corpse, dangling obscenely from the tree on Old Buncombe Road, was a grisly reminder of the community crime. They'd have cut down the salesman and given him a decent burial, but the white dog stood guard over his master's corpse day after day, savagely threatening anyone who came near the hanging tree. So the salesman's body withered and rotted underneath the tree beside the road, filling the air with a terrible stench as it desiccated in the summer heat. It was many weeks before the body and dog disappeared from the Old Buncombe Road. A few months later, a man who'd participated in the salesman's lynching happened to be walking down Old Buncombe Road at night. As he drew near the hanging tree, his nose wrinkled in disgust as a whiff of rotten flesh swept past his face and his stomach roiled. He staggered backward, his arm over his nose, wondering what was causing the terrible stench. Then he spotted the hanging tree and saw upon it a glowing, desiccated corpse dangling obscenely by the neck from one of its branches, and beneath the ghostly figure stood a huge white dog with glowing red eyes. The dog growled menacingly when he saw the man on the road, and the man stumbled backward over the rut in the center of the road and started to run. With an ear-shattering series of barks, the white dog pursued the fleeing man with supernatural speed. The man whipped this way and that, spinning around, leaping into the woods to dodge around trees, trying to avoid the huge dog snapping at his heels. If he fell, the dog would be at his throat immediately. The man crashed headlong into a tree and flung himself upward. Below him, the ghost dog leapt, and sharp teeth closed on the man's hand. Pain ripped through him, and he climbed higher, trying to shake off the glowing beast. "Let go!" he screamed, kicking at it again. Suddenly, the white dog turned to mist before his eyes and swirled away. Realizing that the white dog might reappear at any moment, the man seized his chance. He slithered down the tree and ran all the way home. His wife sent a neighbor to fetch the doctor, who stitched up his hand as best he could. The white dog had nearly severed the palm, and the nerves were so badly damaged that he was crippled in that hand for the rest of his life. The man later learned that every person who had participated in the lynching of the salesman was attacked by the ghost of the white dog. Many, like himself, were crippled in some way. As for the fellow who'd shot and injured the white dog, well, his 4-year-old son disappeared and was never seen again.
Green Lantern, a Michigan ghost story, retold by S.E. Schlosser. There once was a lighthouse keeper who had lived on St. Martin's Island with his children, whom he loved dearly. They were all alone there, for the mother had died long before. Wanting the best for his daughter and son, the keeper had insisted that they continue their education, and for this purpose he had purchased a small dory for them, which they rowed across to the mainland each day to attend school. One spring afternoon, the children were rowing home from school when they were caught in a sudden squall. Their rowboat overturned and the children were thrown into the depths of the lake, never to be seen again. Their bodies were never recovered. The shattered father searched the beaches of St. Martin's Island every night for the rest of his life, hoping to find his children. After his death, people started seeing the light of a green lantern moving along the beaches of St. Martin just before a storm. Folks said it was the spirit of the dead lighthouse keeper continuing his search. Others claimed that the phantom lighthouse keeper was still on duty, using his lantern to guide ships to safety so their crews would not share the fate of his poor little children.
Devil on Washington Rock, a True New Jersey Story, by S.E. Schlosser. The dream was so vivid she didn't realize at first that it was a dream. The party was crowded, the guests cheerful, the food delicious. Then a rumor began to circulate among the guests. The devil was coming to the party. The devil was on the way.
She didn't pay much attention at first, until a hush came over the crowd. Turning to see what it was, she saw a tall, handsome blonde man standing in the doorway greeting his hostess. Around her, the murmurs began. It was the devil. He had come. She watched out of the corner of her eye as the devil made the rounds of the room. He looked so ordinary, it was hard to believe he was the devil. Then he came to her group. As soon as he joined them, she knew the rumor was true. This was not someone to be trifled with. Frightened, she grabbed for a Bible her hostess had left laying on a nearby table and threw it at the devil. For a moment their eyes locked. The devil's eyes were full of ferocious anger, terrible evil, and malevolent malice, directed right at her. She thought she was dead. Then she woke and lay trembling in her bed with the light on until dawn. The next morning was the end of term. Her parents and younger sister helped her clear out her dorm room and pack the car. It was dusk before they settled into their seats for the 2-hour drive home. They talked excitedly as they drove towards their home in New Jersey, interrupting each other often, contradicting themselves, and laughing. It was good to be together again. They were 15 minutes from home when they left the highway. Her father turned onto Washington Rock Road that led up the mountain, through the C-bend around the Washington Rock State Park, and then down the other side of the mountain. As they drove up the steep hill, a noisy motorcycle tailgated them, trying to pass even though the road was windy and narrow. Finally, the hill grew so steep that the driver was forced to slow down, and eventually they pulled away from him entirely. The car reached the top of the hill and started around the long C curve that took them through one end of the park. The park was dark and still. The whole family automatically looked to their right, out over the gorgeous view of the New York City skyline. They all saw the small park cart sitting next to the road just inside the park boundary. It was parked directly underneath the only street light, where you couldn't fail to see it. And inside the vehicle... She started trembling fiercely. Inside the vehicle was a tall, handsome, blonde man with eyes full of ferocious anger, terrible evil, and malevolent malice. It was the man from her dream, the man everyone said was the devil. The tension in the car was palpable. She had mentioned her dream to no one, but her parents and her sister all felt the evil pulsing from the still figure in the cart. No one spoke as they drove past the man. Suddenly the engine gave a strange cough. Her father turned the motor once, twice, in a silent, desperate battle to keep moving. She gripped her hands together, praying silently as she stared at the figure opposite their car. The engine caught again, and her father pressed down hard on the accelerator. Then they were past the man, and roaring away from the park and towards the downward slope of the mountain. She was sweating profusely, unable to stop shaking. She looked back out the window at the man in the park and saw the motorcycle come roaring at last to the top of the hill. It drove halfway around the C-bend, and as it drew opposite the figure in the cart, she heard the engine of the motorcycle cough and then stall. And then the park was out of view, and they were riding silently towards home, not daring to speak until they were safely indoors. She often wondered what had happened to the man on the motorcycle.
Storm Hag, a Pennsylvania ghost story, retold by S. E. Schlosser. She lurks below the surface of the lake near Presque Isle, her lithe form forever swimming through the weeds and the mire. Pale and green of skin, her yellow eyes shine luminously in the dark, and her thin, long arms wrap themselves around the unwary, while foul green pointed teeth sink into soft flesh and sharp nails at the end of long bony fingers stroke you into the deepest sleep there is. She is called by many names, but to sailors of Lake Erie she is known as the Storm Hag. The creature is a sea witch, an evil Jenny Greenteeth who summons the storms and pulls shipwrecked sailors down into her evil embrace to live with her forever at the bottom of the lake. Sometimes she waits until the calm right after the storm to attack. When the sailors relax their guard, lulled into thinking that the danger has passed with the storm hag bursts forth from the dark waters of the lake, spewing forth lightning and wind like venom, and the ship will vanish, never to be seen again. There is only one warning before she strikes. If you listen closely, you can hear her singing against the harsh wind and the thrashing waves. Come into the water, love. Dance beneath the waves, where dwell the bones of sailor lads inside my saffron cave. If you can, flee immediately, for the storm hag is right beside you. If you cannot, then pray to your God for mercy, for the storm hag will grant you none. Her whirlpool will suck down your ship, and her long green arms will lovingly stroke you into the depths of the lake, where she will feast on your body among the weeds.
Trapper's Ghost, a Labrador ghost story retold by S.E. Schlosser. There once was a trapper who roamed the wilds of Labrador on a sleigh pulled by 8 pure white huskies. He was a tall man, dressed in layer upon layer of animal skins, who drove his team with a terrible ferocity across the frozen tundra. The trapper was a cruel man, and the people in the local towns did not like him, though they tolerated his company when he came to town because of the rich animal skins he brought with him. When he came to a town, a trapper would sell his skins and then drink away his money at the local tavern. And when he wasn't drunk himself, the trapper assaulted the local women, picked fights with the hard-working townsmen, and tried to sell alcohol to the natives. After a few days of such behavior, the constable would toss the trapper out on his ear. Then the trapper would resume his roaming and trapping until he came to another town. No one knows exactly how the trapper met his fate, although it was rumored that he went a little too far in his pursuit of a local innkeeper's fair wife and was shot to death by her disgruntled husband. Other folk say he lived to an old age and died out on the trail. But it swiftly became clear that death did not end the roaming of the cruel trapper. Each winter, the trapper's ghost roams the wilds of Labrador on a sleigh pulled by 8 white huskies. They say that his spirit was refused entry into heaven and remains forever in Labrador, atoning for the many sins he committed during his lifetime by helping lost travelers find their way home. Many a weary soul has looked up from their frantic circling to see a large sleigh pulled by white dogs coming toward them. If they follow it, they are led to safety. Once a trapper found himself caught in a terrible blizzard, far from the nearest town. As he sought in vain to find a place to shelter from the storm, the phantom trapper appeared with his sleigh, animal skins flapping in the raging wind and blinding snow. The phantom tenderly lifted the nearly frozen man, placed him among the rugs on his sleigh, and drove the dying trapper to the nearest town. The phantom carried the man right into the inn, placed him gently on a chair by the door, summoned the innkeeper to care for the man, and then vanished right before the astonished innkeeper's eyes.
The Shrouded Horseman, a Wisconsin ghost story, retold by S.E. Schlosser. When the Civil War ended, Jeremiah Jones found himself a free man. Eager to make a new life for himself, he made his way north to Milwaukee. For several years, he worked odd jobs until he earned enough money to buy himself a big white horse and a dray, a low, flatbed wagon without sides. Shortly thereafter, he was hired on as a drayman with the Philip Fest Brewing Company. Jeremiah began his delivery rounds, greeting everyone with a cheerful smile and a joke that delighted the brewery's customers and earned him a good reputation. Jeremiah quickly earned enough to buy property on the outskirts of town, where he built a beautiful little cottage. Once he was settled, Jeremiah decided it was time to marry. He had his eye on a pretty girl named Lucille. Her parents were surprised by the match, but quickly resigned themselves to the situation, not wishing to alienate their only daughter. But for Lucille's brother James, it was another matter entirely. He thought Lucille had married beneath her, and he hated the former slave for stealing his sister's heart. Lucille left her parents' home forever in the dray drawn by the large white horse, and she never set foot in that part of the city again. She and Jeremiah lived simply but happily in their cottage by the woods. 3 months passed when Lucille returned home early one evening to find Jeremiah lying dead in a puddle of blood on the floor of the barn. His face was battered almost beyond recognition, his arms and legs broken in several places. Half hidden under his leg, she saw a silver pocket watch, one that she had last seen attached to the waistcoat of her brother James. The white horse and dray had been hacked to pieces. Lucille's brother had fled the city by the time the sheriff arrived at his house to question him. A warrant was put out for his arrest, but James was nowhere to be found. Lucille put the cottage up for sale and left town. No one in the area wanted to buy the house, thinking it had been tainted by such a brutal murder, and so it remained empty. And that was that, until one evening at dusk, when the phantom appeared in a dray drawn by a glowing white horse. The driver was a tall figure wearing a gray shroud that whipped and flapped under the force of an invisible gale. The spirit of Jeremiah Jones had returned to avenge himself upon his murderer and would not rest until he found him. About 6 months after the sightings began, James, the murdering brother, returned to Lucille's house. "Lucy," he called. "Lucy, I'm back." James staggered around the yard, having fortified his courage at the local bar. Suddenly, he spied the phantom dray careening down the road with the shrouded figure standing up in its seat, cracking his long whip ferociously. The white horse was wild-eyed with fury. It picked up speed when it saw the man who had killed its master, and it gave a scream of fright that stopped Lucille's brother in his tracks. The ghost snapped the end of the whip around James' leg and pulled him off his feet. Then, the horse and dray drove right through him. James gave a sort of gasp and then flopped onto the ground, dead as a mackerel, with a look of sheer terror upon his face.
You've been listening to a session of Midnight Macabre on Triangle Radio Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. If you want to check out our program guide, please visit our website at www.trianglereadingservice.org. While you're there, you might notice we have several programs on podcast. Meanwhile, this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I'm Kurt Benroot for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. From me and from my fellow readers, good night. Thank you.